Could voters be looking at a half-cent sales tax to fix Jacksonville's pension mess? Meanwhile, there's a new plan and budget for downtown, but disgrace for a national news anchor. Just some of the headlines making news this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, but now catch our daily podcast on iTunes as well. Just ahead, we've got all the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, local author Jane Wood, plus our own contributor Nick Michaud with his take on 50 Shades of Grey. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our Media Roundtable, the sweetest bunch in town on this Valentine's Day, and the smartest, Fred Matthews here, for who writes for The Examiner. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
A.G. Gankarski, columnist with Folio Weekly and Florida Politics.
Morning.
And Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning.
Guys, it's great to have you on the show. Lots of news to discuss from the week. And by the way, it's 549-2937 to join us. We're going to begin with local politics as the city's mayor's race continues to heat up with lots of accusations and counter-accusations about taxes and spending. As all that is going on, the city council may put before the voters the chance to decide whether Jacksonville should enact a half-cent sales tax to dig out of our mountain of pension debt. As we begin the show, we want to know, what are your thoughts about a sales tax to fix pension problems in Jacksonville? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email and tweet the show. Fred Matthews, let's begin with you. The City Council's Bill Gulliford introduced this legislation Tuesday. A half-cent sales tax election might be happening in May. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, it's good to see that Councilman Gulliford is going to lead the charge on this, especially since he's going unopposed in the spring election. So it's easy for him to say, as many folks will, council will say, that they're going to ask the voters to increase taxes on themselves for what is really an inside baseball problem. I mean, it is a citywide problem, yes, we can say that economically, but it basically is inside baseball. This is a situation that the taxpayers did not create, but the city government is asking them to help them make a decision that we elected them to make, and that is to fix the pension problem. And then you have this complicated mix that Gulliver is proposing that nobody can really explain competently to the voters. I'm sure Tim will try.
This is literally like a 3 or 4 paragraph sort of thing. I like writing about pensions, but even this is, you do the sales
even
tax,
you do the
property tax, and you put your left foot in, your right foot out, and it is a complicated sort of thing. And the point that you just made, though, of this is going to the voters for an inside baseball sort of thing. It reminds me of when I get my car fixed. I always have this feeling of, you know, earlier in the week I had a car that worked, mm-hmm. and now I have a car that worked, but I'm out $500, and I didn't really get anything. You go to voters and say, tax yourself. It's not like we're getting more police and fire protection. Basically paying a bill that's been due for years.
We're paying down a big credit card bill, basically. Dan Scanlon.
Well, you know, he's right. You're both right. That when we had recent sales tax increases, they went to things like roads and infrastructure, better Jacksonville. This, there is no visible improvement from it. It's going to be, Tim, your brakes needed work anyway. They still felt okay. They may feel a little better later. So that's it. It's a little better feeling later. And of course, how many members of the city council, plus the mayor, plus a lot of our city leaders, are up for re-election? How is this going to fly in a no-tax mayor campaign with the rest of the city council members running versus, wow, this is a great point for their competitors?
Right.
Can you imagine the ads, though? trying to boil this down to a, you know, so-and-so supported taxes.
Let's talk about that. A.G. Gankarski, we've got two candidates in the race for mayor. Incumbent Mayor Alvin Brown and GOP frontrunner Lenny Curry saying, absolutely, we cannot raise taxes. Another contender, Bill Bishop, is saying the only way to solve this problem is to raise tax.
Yeah, and we're seeing a gap between executive level thinking and legislative thinking in that schism. What's funny is that you know, Lenny Curry came out yesterday afternoon with a press release saying that he wanted a 90-day financial audit on the city, an emergency audit, before he would, you know, even think about next steps. Alvin Brown, his people keep saying that no new taxes for four more years. You know, so you basically have these two candidates who, you know, are outside what, you know, what council seems to be proposing. And you've got Lenny Curry basically taking a stand against the council leadership of his party, which...
Of his own party.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll see if that plays out.
Which he helped get elected.
And at the same time, you've got another, you've got Bill Bishop saying he's in the race, saying we've got to raise taxes. Mayor Brown is saying, no, we can solve this with the plan that they've already put forward that would involve JEA shouldering some of the burden.
6 months ago, we were sitting around this table with others who said the JEA deal won't ever work. It won't ever get past the goal. And a lot of people were poo-pooing it. The JEA, you know, it's not going to do it. Here we sit today. The JEA is willing to do a deal that will basically switch money between government departments. Yes, the city will get a little less money from the JEA for the play around, but we will have money for the pension plan, and you don't have to tax the taxpayers on it, and it won't necessarily be an increase on the JEA bill. What is wrong with that? How are you going to debate that when you get before taxpayers to have this inevitable tax debate here and sell them on something that they can't understand?
Because it has the same problem that the tax thing has, which is it's just insanely complicated. And there's a and that doesn't mean it's wrong. Government is complicated. But the idea of saying JEA gives us the money. Okay, that's easy. But now it's JEA gives us the money, and then we reduce their contribution, this percent, and it feels like with that many details, there's too much room for the city to get screwed over.
But that's why they have agreements. That's why we have interlocal agreements with the surrounding communities. That's why we have an agreement with the JEA. The agreement we have right now is complicated. Nobody knows it except for the city council, the auditor's department. The mayors don't even know how that thing works. Only the auditors and they'll know how one can explain.
I kind of wonder what these auditors think about Curry's call for a 90-day audit. what he's saying is that they're not doing their jobs right. I mean, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what the subtext is. And it's got to be seen as a slap in the face. But, I mean, we've seen the Lenny Curry campaign for about 9 months now. And, you know, a lot of these solutions are broad brush solutions. I mean, he's basically making his argument that you got to get back the first principles as a city and look at all of these issues, you know, from the genesis. And people say, well, he's oversimplifying the issue, but that seems to be what works for Republican candidates.
At the same time, you've got a former Republican mayor, John Delaney, coming out, Dan Scanlon, and saying, we need to raise taxes. We need new money.
You know, I think even at this table many months ago, some of us were discussing why wasn't this an option to be discussed. We never realized it would be this complicated. And, you know, voters in the city, if they see a ballot question, if it ever gets that far, that is a few inches long, I get the impression that's an automatic no. Boom. I just fill in that hole and move on.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, as we discuss the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. We want to know what you're thinking. Call us up, 549-2937. Let's go to Charles on the West Side. Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to kind of throw a monkey wrench in the cogs there. I think a sales tax is a good idea, but why don't we tackle two problems at once? Why don't we not do a sales tax on everything and do an increased sales tax on tobacco products to tackle some of our health issues? Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charles. Okay, what about that? Specialty taxes or sin taxes, as they're sometimes called?
It's not on the table. I mean, it's not on the table. Nobody's going to discuss that. I mean, we're already up to seven cents right now. If this deal goes through, you'll be up to 7.5 cents. Figure that out when you go to the pump the next time. Find an extra. You're going to be up to 7.5 cents. That's what they're telling you, is that they're going to jack up your taxes at the pump on you. The legislature already gives them the authority to do it, I believe, so they're fine with it. But none of that other stuff is on the table, folks, and it's not going to be on the table. What's on the table is what's on the table, and that is we want to tax you to pay off a debt that we should have paid. That's what the city council is saying by this. And they're going to hand it, by the way, what, nine people are leaving. So they're going to vote. They want to vote on this. At least Gulliford wants them to vote on this and then hand it off to the next council who won't know anything about how it works.
Well, if you're ever going to have a council that would pass this, it would be one where almost
where everyone's leaving.
Right,
like, yeah.
To go back to something that the AG said, talking about the audit, I found it interesting when I read your story yesterday, and I didn't have time to actually dig back to my own archives, but covering the race when Mayor Brown won, I have this fairly strong memory of him saying
the same thing.
You know, because you'd ask, hey, do you have specifics? No, but I'll get into office and work. First, I think he said 100 days, so I guess
nobody outside that bubble could have those specifics.
Right, there's no way possibly of giving you specifics. No, I get into office. Exact same sort of thing that recycles every 4 years.
Dan Scanlon.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier John Delaney. John Delaney was a more popular mayor in many cases, and of course, Better Jacksonville was under his watch, and there were benefits to it. It was easy to talk about adding a little extra coming out of your wallet if you knew allegedly there'd be new buildings, new superstructures,
new roads,
public access buildings, right. You know, et cetera.
That was a completely different time, though. I mean, Delaney had unprecedented political capital. He had to use a lot of
and
it
the to economy
get
was good.
Yeah, the economy had been booming. We've had two recessions since. And, you know, what we're seeing now, really, you know, with this deal we're discussing, the street infrastructure issues and everything like that, is the culmination of decade after decade of, you know, low tax policies where we expand and basically predicate future projections on growth. You know, growth can only take you so far. And, you know, now everybody's basically saying that the bills are coming due. And the real discussion is, well, has it been fiscal mismanagement or has it been we've just been starving the beast?
Now, we may all be talking about something that might not even happen as far as this tax thing is concerned, because they've got to get it through the council, got to get through the finance committee first, and the rules committee's got to deal with it. And then they've got to bring it back to the council for a vote. And it may not even get that far, given the time frame they have. They talk about the May election, but it's still going to be a tough road to hoe. And then you've got to, then it comes down to this is after the primary. So presuming that Mayor Brown makes it past the primary, and then it will be up to him to look at whether he's going to veto it or not.
And he
said he would. This is holding fast. So this may not ever get to the voters.
Bill on the South Side. Hey, Bill, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Two or three quick points. One is, as long as everybody drags Fannie on getting some done, the cost of the bill goes up about 7% a year. So if it's going to be a year before the citizens vote, it's 7% more expensive. I think the second thing on this GA thing that people overlook is that it's in part predicated on the property appraising tax evaluations looking down the road. If those don't go up, how much extra is the bill going to be? And I guess if I may, in a closing comment on all this whole operation, I'm tired of seeing our city run by a city council and a mayor who tries to operate like a big HOA. Gosh, thanks very much.
Interesting.
That's Bill on the South Side. What about that analogy, Tim Givens?
That's an interesting analogy. It's not one I've heard before, but it does kind of encapsulate one view of looking at what they're doing, which is not having this big picture sort of thing. I talked to some people for a story that we did this week on infrastructure, not simply about Liberty Street, but kind of, you know, playing off of that, of the idea of the need for more investment. And several people said that the cities can end up as a catch-up, just fix stuff, you know, as needed, or they can have a big vision, and that Jacksonville in some ways isn't doing either of those. We're not fixing stuff until it actually breaks, and there's no big vision
and
either.
We'll talk about that in just a moment, that collapse downtown, as we take your calls this morning. We want your calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable as we discuss the top stories of the week. 549-2937. Bobby on the North Side. Bobby, go ahead.
Yes, you know, we can rehash where all this came from till the cows come home, but the reality is the pension contribution is going up millions of dollars a year every year. And sooner or later, the taxpayers are going to be faced with the decision to make. When we get the next budget from the mayor that cuts your fire station, your library, your parks, and you have to raise the millage rate, you raise it. And then this sales tax, you have to first increase the millage rate equal to that. People get their bill, then they vote whether they want to do the half-cent sales tax, which is spread over the entire community, renters, people who transit through the region,
And then the voters can decide, because ultimately the voters, until the voters feel the pain of what it's going to take to fix this problem, they will not do anything because they don't trust government. We get shell games all the time. You know, we promise this and we get this. You know, a mayor says he didn't raise taxes, but it's only because he didn't sign the legislation, let it come law without a signature. And then next year, base his budget on the tax increase. And then, you know, we're tired of these games. We want somebody who's going to stand up and make the hard decisions.
That's Bobby on the north side. Thanks for the call. Okay, and he mentioned a lot of the issues. Let's also throw in UF Health. That funding for that safety net hospital downtown, as they opened up a new Northside campus, really exciting about that. The funding for UF Health downtown is also imperiled right now. Lots of issues around town when it comes to spending and revenue. Fred.
We don't have a statesman. We don't have a statesman. We have the same issue that we have in Washington, where we have political animus and party loyalty checking statesmanship in government. And we don't have that here. We have an animus between Republicans, the same issue here locally as they're having nationally, animus between Republicans and Democrats. It's more important that a Republican be in charge than a Democrat be in charge, and particularly this Democrat, so we want him out. So we don't have anybody willing to talk across those party lines on a consistent basis to make this happen. And until we have one, folks, we're not going to see anything happen in town. I mean, there's not going to be another Hans Tansler around here, apparently, for some time.
The dark horse in the race, Bill Bishop, is trying to occupy that space. What do you think about that, his candidacy?
Well, I thought it was interesting that the caller basically made the same sort of point that you did, which was we need somebody to stand up. We don't need this the same sort of thing. But he didn't particularly say who he supported. It didn't sound like, you know, he sees any of the candidates being this visionary sort of leadership.
Dan Scanlon.
Well, you know, he said you have to feel, voters will have to feel the pain. Well, the pension is not something that any voter is feeling right now. For most of us, what's a pension? It doesn't impact me. It has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with the streets that I drive on, the bridges I cross, the facilities I use. Some of those facilities, in fact, are starting to break down from the Better Jacksonville days. So we have, you see it in elsewhere in the country, we're starting to face those infrastructure needs that the Bostons and the Detroits are facing already.
Yeah. And I want to get to the statesman issue a little bit. You know, this is something where Alvin Brown has said consistently. He says it in his messaging that I'm a bipartisan mayor. I work with Republicans, Democrats, Independents. He's had more photo ops with Rick Scott than Lenny Curry has. And, you know, all of that is to say that you can make all of the calls for statesmanship that you want. You can, you know, say that I'm reaching across the aisle. But when it comes down to it, it's a decision that, you know, doesn't really happen in that way. I mean, you basically have like the Jack's Chamber and, you know, professional organizations having, you know, closed-door discussions of who they're supporting. And, you know, these are where the real discussions of the city happen.
Yeah, but I think that Alvin had that opportunity when he came in. I mean, he came in, I wouldn't say necessarily having a lot of political capital.
Yeah.
It was a surprise win, but
I think you have to look at the way he's governed based on that, that he probably, in his administration, probably believes that he has a small amount of political capital as a Democrat. And so he has governed as a conservative Democrat in this city. And I think that He probably, if you're looking into the mindset of that group at City Hall, there, as you wrote in Florida Politics, yeah. AG, they see their plight as a prisoner's dilemma.
Yes.
If they come out in favor of a tax increase, they will get slammed. If they hold fast to the campaign pledge not to raise taxes, they will also be criticized.
But the problem is that, particularly with the type of campaign Curry is running, it's not like the Brown campaign has this great appeal to the Republican voters who Alvin has been governing toward. I mean, he's been a conservative Democratic mayor who is now losing those conservative voters because there's an actual Republican in the race.
Let's go to Ellen in Clay County. Go ahead, Ellen.
Good morning. I am a JEA user in Clay County, and I wondered how the tax increase might affect me.
Sure. Thanks for that question. And that's, as you pointed out, it's complicated.
Well, the tax increase won't affect her. If they vote for a tax increase, then nothing changes.
But if JEA will eventually pass something on to ratepayers if they contribute more money to the pension debt.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, think that's the issue for her.
Yeah, exactly.
On the other hand, if they passed a sales tax, one of the, you know, one way of looking at it as a benefit of that is it's not just property owners. It's people from Clay County who are driving here, using our roads, buying stuff at 7-Eleven.
I mean, on the JEAN, I mean, it's a corporation. You really don't get a vote on that. I mean, you don't get a vote. The board members are all appointed by the mayor and the governor, I believe.
Yeah.
So you don't get a vote on that anyway. It's just going to happen or not. But at least on the tax increase, you might be able, well, in Clay County, unfortunately, you won't be able to vote.
Dan,
if that happens, I can just envision every husband or wife that runs a checkbook who lives in Clay County telling their spouse, you will not buy gas in Duval, you will not shopping at the Publix, you will come here and do it so that we don't have to pay that.
Yeah, for half a tax, half a cent.
But it could, considering how much, what's the percentage of Clay County residents who commute into Jacksonville to work? That could be a fair chunk, ultimately.
Yeah, if you just have to cross,
if you just have to cross and do your shopping in Fleming Island.
Let's go to Gary on the south side. Hi, Gary. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll be brief. Think of Tom Cruise, Show Me the Money. I've been a homeowner for more than a decade, and I love Jacksonville. And about 4 or 5 years ago, we had the gas topple $4 a gallon. And during that summer, I get a 39% increase from JEA. In 6 months, gas went down and the low $2 per gallon. But so therefore, that cost of operation had to have been down proportionally. So where did that $700 million a year go? And next year, we're asking, where can we find $96 million? Well, there's got to be a landfill somewhere.
Thanks for the call, Gary. That's Gary on the south side.
Well, as JEA has already talked about, the fact that they are a coal-fired system means that the benefits that they thought they'd have 20 years ago when the new Northside generating plant and stuff was built, that's not going to happen anymore now. So they've lost. They predicted, and that crystal ball failed.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Join the conversation, 549-2937. And also making headlines this week, control over downtown development was officially handed over Tuesday night to the Downtown Investment Authority, or the DIA. They are working on a long-range plan to develop Jacksonville's urban core. Speaking of downtown, the power lines serving townhomes around that collapsed portion of Liberty Street will be repaired within 2 weeks at city expense, according to city officials. Tim Gibbons, these homeowners down the street here from our building at WJCT have been without power for several weeks, and they're not happy.
They are not happy. And their rage is kind of directed at DOT, at the city, a whole bunch of people. But I find it interesting and perhaps cynical, although I know we don't like to be cynical here. But the quick turnaround of what can the city do? City can't help. It's on the homeowners. And then press conference yesterday, and city's going to help.
Yeah.
You know, not saying a mayor's race is coming up or anything, but...
Yeah, right.
Well,
and you do feel... I mean, I've seen some of the Facebook posts of people that live in that tower. For a 40-degree home for weeks on end is not a lot of fun.
You know, people who have, you know, pets who have trouble finding a motel room where they can, you know, bring their animals with them, and it's been a mess. And particularly when you have a mayor who is focused on downtown, or not even just a mayor, when you have a development community, a city council who has said downtown's important, this is a black eye.
And the larger issue, as you mentioned, A.G. Gankarski, is that the downtown infrastructure has not really been kept up well over the decades, going through many administrations, and now we're seeing evidence of some of those problems.
Right. I mean, they're still isolating the exact cause of what happened on Liberty Street. And, you know, we're going to see these issues again and again. Regarding, you know, the optics of the current issue, people perceive the mayor's office as being behind on this issue. It took them too long to react. And the people who were impacted, the residents that you mentioned before, you know, have been sounding that alarm. And you can fully expect that the Lenny Curry campaign will have a mail piece in the next couple of days, you know, dealing with that issue, talking about the crumbling infrastructure in downtown. That's a meme that they're already dropping, and it's something that we're going to see more of.
Multiple points here. Number one, those parking lots back there were built when the courthouse and the old city hall were built in the 50s and 60s. In my memory, I've never seen any work done on them. Number two, a crane crashed through part of Liberty Street 3 years ago while doing pressure washing because they had been told but ignored, apparently, the fact that that road couldn't handle it. That also impacted the JEA lines there and caused problems, and that is still mired in legal issues trying to get that fixed. That hole is still there. Mm-hmm. So those are two big things. Three, Action News keeps on calling that a bridge. Well, guess what? I learned when I did the stories on the original collapse, that is a DOT bridge.
It is.
Maybe Liberty Street and Coastline Drive, but that is
it's
a bridge.
It's over water.
It is over water. Concrete so you have DOT, you have city, you have JEA, multiple jurisdictions. No surprise, it too is mired in indecision.
Go ahead, Tim.
There's a certain amount when AG talks about the mailers coming out. There's a moment yesterday where I kind of shook my head and said, who actually wants to be mayor? Well, you look at, so Brown could have come out and said, we're going to help these people. And the mayor would have gone out saying, administration squandering millions on a handful of downtown residents.
Yeah.
So he doesn't help, and he looks ineffectual. It really is a Hobson's choice.
You can make an attack mailer out of either way.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Meanwhile, let's talk about the DIA. This is the Downtown Investment Authority. They have the purview now of working on downtown. But they only have a budget for the first year of $2.5 million. That's not enough to undertake any major projects. Their long-term plan involves developing the North and South Banks along the river in downtown Jacksonville. Andre Wallace, the CEO of the DIA, is trying to focus on a master plan for the urban core. Fred Matthews.
Well, Mr. Wallace and his crew are trying to work through this political maze here. He's from, I think, Detroit originally.
Right.
We got him from, and he's trying to work a good plan. I've sat in on a couple of their meetings, and it appears to be, very hopeful. But the unfortunate problem we have right now is what we've been talking about. I mean, these authorities are at the behest of the mayor and the city council. If you aren't getting those members to move with you when you come up with these ideas, it's just going to be hard to do. I think the mayor's office is very supportive of the DIA, and they're going to do as much as they can do for them, as he's done throughout this. The new Hemming Plaza folks down there are coming up with some great plans. They're now going to be part of the jazz festival. All of that is in the mix of the DIA. But the problem, money-wise, is all going to have to wait another 6 months, probably up to about nine, before they get any real money, anything other than what they've already agreed to. Thankfully, the merchants are all on board, for the most part, with the DIA's plan.
So the first year's budget is $2.5 million. They have 23, 24 projects in their plan for the South Bank and North Bank. The ones that they slated to start in 2014 or 2015, because this thing has been in the works for a while, would add up to just over $20 million. So that kind of gives you a sense of, they have $20 million worth of projects that they wanted to do last year and this year.
Yeah.
And a tenth of that, basically, to actually start doing anything.
549-2937, Marty on the South Side. Go ahead, Marty.
Hi, Melissa. Listen to the show all the time.
Thanks.
I work downtown, and I had a question about the DIA's plan for what they had mentioned about the one-way street improvements and improving foot traffic. Now, I don't care as a pedestrian which way the roads are going, and I just know there's some venues and locations down there like Main Street and Bay Street where converting those streets would just be ridiculous, I think. But there are some smaller one-ways. I just wonder where that study came from and what kind of impact statement they have to do before anything like that is put in place.
Yeah, that's Marty on the South Side. Thanks for the call. AG.
Well, and that's a really good question.
Yeah, it is.
they've obviously done a lot of due diligence on it. The camp and, City Hall has been on top of it, but there will be more studies to come. I mean, there's going to be studies on top of studies.
Well, the two-waying idea is a modern urbanist, dream. It basically slows down traffic, makes it safer, makes you notice the shops.
Mm-hmm.
You have street-level retail, you have to see it. Doing it would cost $9 million.
To get rid of all the one-way streets.
Right, and they keep a couple of the main arteries as one way. But the idea is that you don't want people blasting through downtown. You want them
stopping and staying. And,
on the other hand, that was the point of the cobblestones, was to slow people and make it. And people hate those things.
My wife does not like those at all.
Tim, now, what stores?
I have
lived here for a quarter century, and there are actually less businesses in certain parts and less buildings than when I came here.
Chicken and the egg.
That's the catch-22. What, you know, if you put in two-way streets, will it be a more hospitable environment for small business to set up?
Will that get rid of parking? Will that get rid of bike lanes?
Well, I mean, that's the quandary that they're in. And again, they can't ignore the plan for what kind of design are we going to have for Jacksonville Landing. Now, I would think that, and it is, that has to be center of what the DIA has to deal with. Now, this plan is going back to the drawing board. I would think that the DIA should be in with that plan, in with developing a plan with both feet, because that leads, all roads lead right down to the river with the iconic vision that we have of Jacksonville. If we lose that vision, what will they shoot when they come here to see on Sundays?
That landing plan depends on, you know, whether Brown or Curry wins, because Slayman is so in with the Brown campaign that you have to expect that if Curry wins, it's going to be a different narrative for the Jacksonville Landing.
Well, we said that before. Slayman was in with who was Brown's opponent last time? He didn't support Brown going into the last election, but he had to flip over, of course, once Brown got in and he worked with him. Tony Slayman will be fine, because Tony Slayman has been a supporter of politicians for years. It's not going to be, he supports whatever's going to be in place.
He supports the mayor. Whoever the mayor is.
Exactly.
He's
not, that's not going to affect him, but as far as we're concerned, and the DIA, they need to have a plan to help him move that along, because if it turns out to be just another office park downtown on the river, it's not going to work.
If the landing actually gets done, is that a seed? Is that the place where things blossom?
Right.
Well, there's also the shipyards. You know, it's supposed to be announced sometime soon, what Shad Khan's plans are. It basically sounds like a way bigger version of the landing. So if that happens, does that just suck all the life from the landing anyhow?
But if they both get done, then the riverfront is alive, and suddenly there could be some growth potential in the rest
between
of the city.
Well, we need to talk about two other big talkers from the week in the national media world. The Daily Show's Jon Stewart announced this week he's stepping down after 16 years hosting his popular show on Comedy Central. Meanwhile, NBC News anchor Brian Williams stepping down in another way. He's suspended for 6 months after being caught embellishing war stories from his time in Iraq in 2003. Give us a call with your thoughts about that, 549-2937. Dan Scanlon, is that this is something you wanted to mention. Is that an appropriate response from NBC News?
I think so. It gives Lester Holt a chance to anchor the news for 6 months and see if that is the next suitable person to take that chair. Brian had been there for a long time, outlasting a lot of other network anchors. It also means that Brian could respectfully find a way to extricate himself from a very difficult position. My jaw dropped on that one. It just dropped. I trusted. I loved Brian Williams. I loved NBC News. I still love NBC News, but
Well, it's we were discussing the local mayor's race and accusations about, oh, he lied about this, or oh, he's being disingenuous about that. The whole thing with Williams is proof that people expect public figures to tell the truth, and there is a price to pay. At least in some cases, when you don't.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, Brian Williams has gone into an entertainment direction more and more in recent years. He'll go on talk shows like the aforementioned Jon Stewart, you know, other talk shows and tell stories. And, you know, this is something that war correspondents have done since the beginning of time. They take a story and they spin it and they make it bigger. The problem is we have 24/7 archives of digitized YouTube.
Everything's social media, spreads on social media too.
Yeah, so
right away.
He can't tell a story, he can't spin, he can't make a narrative interesting without having a fact checker on him.
That's right.
Well, it's also what role you come from. I remember, you know, big fan of David Sedaris, who talks about his stories being true enough sort of thing. That works if you're talking about a Mark Twain rancor sort of, you know, you're telling stories that have a germ of truth. Brian Williams says anything, whether it's at the anchor's desk or at you know, on a talk show, it's believed to be an actual fact.
Right.
He's not just telling a story.
And in particular, he was caught embellishing a story involving the military.
Yeah.
Fred Matthews.
With other folks on the aircraft who knew better. And we've seen that story play out time and time again. I mean, even for those who have even for other soldiers who've been involved in taking literary license with their old war stories and then get caught up with a bunch of medals on their chest that they didn't deserve. I mean, it's just very disappointing for Brian to do this. But you're right, AG. I mean, he's gotten into this entertainment wing of NBC News, going on these shows and telling these stories like Dan Rather used to do, these old Texas stories that Dan used to do, and eventually catches up with you because you miss a point in order to make the point a little more catchy to the listener.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is any story that any of the four of us write is immediately responded to on our individual websites because mm-hmm. we have the ability for people to react. And sometimes it can carry and become its own story. Brian, some might say if he'd kept his mouth shut mm-hmm. the last time he talked, he wouldn't have had those soldiers coming up immediately on social media and saying no. But no, he embellished, he kept on adding, and it yep. bit him in the
and,
you know what.
And my only thought yep. was, there's clearly no Holly Hunter at NBC News to tell a guy like Brian Williams to get his ethics in order. That was my immediate reaction to this whole mess.
Well, interesting.
If only Holly Hunter had been there.
when you talk about the, you know, 24-hour fact-checking and all of that, I remember Ronald Reagan, his old stories of, yeah, I met a woman who, and they were kind of sort of true, and now a politician says, I met somebody who did X, Y, and Z. It's fact-checked, that person is tracked down. It's a different world where you can't just kind of tell these, it was a kind of sort of true sort of
sure.
thing.
Well, think about Thomas Friedman and his cab driver stories. Every place he goes, he's talking to a cab driver who happens to tell him exactly what he wants to hear to support his neoliberal narrative. I mean, the irony about Brian Williams, he's the first person to get in trouble for lying about the Iraq War. So yeah, it only took a dozen
yeah,
years.
Yeah, that is ironic. All right, speaking of irony and just face-palming news from the week, it is our weekly roundup of the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from across the Sunshine State. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. And by the way, this is Gershwin Swanee. Somebody asked me. Only in Florida. Only in Florida do people list their occupation on an arrest report as drug dealer. West Palm Beach deputies say 25-year-old Robert Phillips was collared after driving right in front of an unmarked car, nearly causing a crash. Turns out Phillips was actually in the middle of a drug transaction, and he explained that on the arrest report on the line that says occupation. He's facing multiple drug charges and remains in jail on a $242,000 bond.
See, at least he told the truth, unlike Brian Williams.
He was very honest.
Brian Williams can learn from.
Only in Florida do architects design breast-shaped buildings only to see them torn down. Yes, a racy landmark in Winter Park was demolished this week. The building near I-4 has been the home of several strip clubs over the decades, and it's best known by its original name, the Booby Trap, which described its domed design.
So that's reconstructive surgery, right?
Pretty much. And finally, only in Florida are wrestling events haunted by the ghost of Macho Man Randy Savage.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, on the heels that Savage is about to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame posthumously, comes news that his ghostly apparition was spotted at a wrestling event in Live Oak this week. You can look at the photos online and judge for yourself. There is an image there. Now, is Macho Man returning to Earth to accept his Hall of Fame induction, or did he just get a really great payday? You decide.
The Macho Man from the spirit world.
And thanks to A.G. Gankarski, Dan Scanlon, Fred Matthews, and Tim Gibbons. Guys, happy Valentine's Day. Thanks for being here.
Love being here.
Thank you.
Right. Still to come, speaking of the holiday, author Siggy Buckley will join us on some tips for coping with February 14th if you're single or divorced. Plus,
much of the controversy over the books hinges on the question of whether the story acts as a passionate form of advocacy for those who live alternative lifestyles, or if it acts to promote violence against women.
Contributor Nick Michaud on this weekend's big release, 50 Shades of Grey. That's next.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Thad Starner invented a wearable computer back in the early 90s.
He named her Lizzie, and he went everywhere with her.
You really do feel superhuman at that point.
But where did Lizzie stop and Thad begin?
Because it's invisible, it's more likely to influence you and have an effect on you.
I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller. Can computers change us?
On the next episode of Invisibilia from NPR.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Looking for something different musically? Listen to After Hours weeknights at 7 on 89.9 FM, from classical to country.
Give me a word, give me a sign. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find? Lay me on the ground.
Welcome back. Well, she's a former teacher turned author. Jacksonville's own Jane Wood has carved out a real niche writing historic adventures for middle grade readers. Kids across the country love her books. They learn about American history while also taking in a great adventurous story. I spoke with Jane about her new book for kids. It's called Lost in Boston.
They get to visit the Paul Revere House and the Old North Church, and they tour the USS Constitution, that magnificent ship that's anchored in Boston Harbor. So in keeping with the theme of all my books, I like to weave a little history into a fun storyline for kids that has a little mystery and adventure.
And that's First Coast author Jane Wood. She'll be signing copies of her new book, Lost in Boston. You can catch her tomorrow on Valentine's Day from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble at the St. John's Town Center. Speaking of books, we want your responses for the next book we're featuring on this show. It's our First Coast Connect Book Club. We love doing this. Now, later this month, our book club blogger Stacy Goldring will discuss The Sense of an Ending by author Julian Barnes. The story is narrated by a retired man named Tony Webster. He recalls how he and his clique met another boy at school named Adrian Finn and vowed to remain friends for life. When the past catches up with Tony, he reflects on the paths he and his friends have taken. The story deals with themes of memory and time. So we want to know, why do you think we edit our memories over time? Is our memory unreliable? And what are your thoughts when you remember your cliques and your friends from school? Email your comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org about the sense of an ending. We want you to be part of our book club, so we really look forward to your emails. Well, Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and the hype is at a fever pitch for the new film 50 Shades of Grey, out this weekend and based, of course, on the best-selling book by the same name. Our contributor Nick Michaud says 50 Shades might not be the healthiest expression of love and romance.
50 Shades of Grey, a film based on the book by E.L. James, will be coming to theaters this Valentine's Day weekend. The book series has been hugely popular, having sold more than 100 million copies worldwide. For numerous reasons, the books have received a great deal of criticism, ranging from critique of its prose to criticism of its explicit subject matter. Much of the story revolves around a relationship that in many ways could be considered abusive. It's hard to say for sure if it is a love story. But at the very least, 50 Shades of Grey delves deeply into the conflicted relationship between Anastasia Steele and Christian Grey as Anastasia enters his world of bondage and submission. Much of the controversy over the books hinges on the question of whether the story acts as a passionate form of advocacy for those who live alternative lifestyles, or if it acts to promote violence against women. Even without getting into the rather explicit details, we can recognize that 50 Shades of Grey likely doesn't interest most of its readers just because of the physical content, but because of the powerful push and pull between the two main characters as Anastasia struggles against Grey's desire to maintain their relationship as a kind of business transaction. And that fact only seems to remind us of the commercialization of love. After all, we're talking about a love story that involves a man requiring a woman to sign two contracts. One, to agree to not discuss their bedroom life with anyone, and two, to accede to the fact that their relationship has no love content, only the physical. Despite Anastasia's repeated insistence that she does not want to sign the second, Gray attempts to manipulate her into doing so anyway. Part of the contract requires Anastasia not look Gray in the eyes. One interpretation of this is that it's just a game played by two adults. Yet on the other hand, eye contact is something we tend to promote in men, but discourage in women. Consider what we often see in our media when a man and a woman meet. He walks into a bar, looks around, and then makes eye contact with a beautiful woman. They share a tense and sizzling moment, and then she looks down demurely. It's a kind of hunt, where the primal man casts his eyes about for and then stares down his helpless prey, much like Christian Grey. With that in mind, it makes me wonder if Grey is really best described as a predator. Consider, for example, the fact that Grey basically stalks, intimidates, and emotionally abuses Anastasia. He spends a good deal of time following her, learning her habits, and setting emotional traps to catch his prey. So perhaps the controversy about 50 Shades of Grey isn't really about the better left behind the scenes intimacies of our lives. Instead, the questions that come to my mind are about love and what we consider romance. Have we genuinely reduced our social concept of love to one that can be distilled into contracts like Grey's, really not so different from prenuptial agreements? Certainly, there are good questions about whether or not this film will portray women as strong or portray them as willing victims who really want a man who doesn't want to love them. I wonder, too, though, about the portrayal of men. Is it true that the most romantic fantasy man we can see this Valentine's Day is one who believes that he shouldn't love, and that the person with whom he shares his deepest intimacies shouldn't even look him in the eye?
That's our contributor, Nick Michaud. You can send your thoughts to Nick at philosophylives@gmail.com. Well, finally this hour, when it comes to Valentine's Day, you either love it or hate it, right? First Coast author Siggy Buckley has a new book out just in time for this romantic of holidays. It's written for singles, and actually she has advice for singles and people who are divorced. Siggy Buckley on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Alyssa, and thanks for having me on your show again.
Great to have you on. So Valentine's Day, if you have a loved one, is sweet and romantic. If you don't, it's not so much fun. So you're really targeting that audience, right?
That's right. I mean, if you're in a relationship, it's all wonderful. But if you're not showered by chocolate and great gifts, it can become a red flag. And my book is trying to help singles to navigate the dating game, the dating field, and it's full of advice and full of stories that are based on my own experience.
So tell us about your experience, especially here in Jacksonville, being single. Go ahead.
I didn't gather my experiences here in Jacksonville, I have to say. I lived in Ireland at the time, but it's based on my own experience when I was getting divorced at 40 and had to start all over again to find somebody in love. So the dating game, everything that happened was earlier on there. Talking about Jacksonville is a different thing. I think a lot of people know the hot spots where to go, and there are a lot of events. If you're asking for tips where to find a person, there are a lot of singles events out there. Jacksonville and the beaches have a lot to offer. My approach is slightly different. I have, and I'm writing about this in the book, I have a two-tonged approach. Number one, first of all, to be your attitude, to be proactive, to put yourself out there, because a lot of people forget about that. They stay at home if they're single and they don't dare to go out, or they have forgotten how the dating game really works because they have been out of practice, having been married for a long time, and the dating rules have changed. So you have to make time also for that, for socializing, which is difficult if you're working hard and if you have singles to look after. And what goes with that is I want you to keep an open mind for opportunities everywhere, because you can meet somebody in every situation everywhere, to be open to new experiences, maybe even put out the word to your friends, and maybe even to move out of your comfort zone a little bit, try new things, join new clubs and try new activities. So that would be the one tongue that I mentioned, the one side approach. And the other thing is I would like to talk about the person's attitude and personality. Ask yourself a few questions, whether you're really ready. And these are pieces of advice that I would give to everybody all over. I did that in Ireland too, in every city, not just Jacksonville. It applies really to human nature, because we are surrounded by so many possibilities, online dating and all of that, which can be even too much, an overload of possibilities and an overload of choices.
And we're almost out of time, so let's mention the name of the book one more time so people might be able to pick it up for Valentine's Day.
Next Time Lucky, How to Find Your Mr. Right. That nexttimelucky.com is the website, and I want people to stay true to yourself, know what they are looking for, get themselves ready for a new partner, forget about the baggage, forget about thinking about the past, to live in the here and now.
That's right. And we're out of time, Siggy. It's Next Time Lucky by author Siggy Buckley. Happy Valentine's Day, Siggy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for being with us. Have a good holiday. And that is our show. Thanks for tuning in today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our show producer is Sean Birch, and the show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They're now on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, a panel of journalists joins Diane for analysis of the week's top national news stories. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Happy Valentine's Day. Have a great weekend.
First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.